From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The clock is ticking. Time is getting short for combating climate change, and we're not acting quickly enough to head off potential calamity, said the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change yesterday in Berlin. But we can still avert the worst if we get going fast, said the panel. This hour On Point, crunch time on this century's climate. In Berlin yesterday, here's German economist Otmar Edenhofer, co-chaired the committee that wrote the new climate change report. He said, we cannot afford to lose another decade.
Emissions keep rising and we risk for the second half of the century unabated climate change. And there is an increasing awareness around the globe that unabated climate change poses a huge risk.
And the chairman of the panel, Rajendra Pachauri, saying there must be quick action and global effort in order to curb the effects of climate change.
The high-speed mitigation train would need to leave the station soon, and all of global society would have to get on board.
Tall order, but necessary to avert large potential risks, said the panel. Joining me from London is Gautam Naik. He covers science and the environment for the Wall Street Journal. You can link to his article, UN Climate Change Report Says Worst Scenarios Can Still Be Avoided, at our website, onpointradio.org. Gautam Naik, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So the time frame that's being described here for still heading off the worst, what's it look like?
Well, it depends what scenario is pursued by various governments. The essential message of this UN panel was that the pace of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions is accelerating, and this is going to bring on really worrisome levels of warming more quickly than had been anticipated even before, within a few decades. And that problem, however, can be fixed provided we take action quickly. The scenario for acting quickly would be that if countries are able to get together and cut CO2 emissions really dramatically, then we may be able to limit the extent of the warming and the time frame to just, you know, 2 or 3 decades. Otherwise, it may just really, you know, increase pretty dramatically, and the effects would last much longer. And the reason for that is that when the greenhouse gas emissions enter the atmosphere and have their effect, there's a lag. So the actual effects aren't felt much later on.
We're reading here that we would have to see an intensive push over the next 15 years and then more beyond that. But right away over the next 15 years, what about the kind of measures that have been taken so far? What did the panel say about their effectiveness, their scale in comparison to the scale of the challenge?
Well, I'd say that the effort to reduce the emissions of carbon dioxide have largely failed. Various countries, about 200 of them, got together many years ago and decided to cut emissions quite significantly. Many countries have not been able to keep up to their promise. So all we have is a scenario of accelerating greenhouse gas emissions. So that is a huge policy problem that will somehow have to be addressed. This UN panel doesn't prescribe what to do. It tells you what the scenario is or scenarios are and lets policymakers make this decision. There are lots of, industries that would face huge billions of dollars of expenditure to revamp their workings in order to meet these kind of CO2 emission guidelines. And it's not clear whether they'll actually step up and do that.
But as I read this, they say that overall the cost of this would be a few hundredths of a percent of growth over the next century if this path is pursued.
That's right. One of the key messages in this particular report is that the UN panel is going out of its way to say, look, we face a problem. This problem is going to get worse if we act later rather than sooner. But we can actually avert this in several ways, which I'm happy to tell you about, if we act quickly. And the cost of that will not be that significant in terms of global economic output. That's a key message, because there's always been a strong critical voice on the other side saying the cost of doing this for something that is somewhat uncertain, the science, there are uncertainties, is so huge. Maybe we shouldn't really embark on this till we really know what's going on. But the UN panel is saying, look, the economic cost of decarbonizing the global economy, as they put it, i.e. getting rid of a reliance on fossil fuels, is not that heavy a burden to bear.
And if we don't, I mean, the talk is of collapse of ice sheets, rapid rise in sea levels, difficulty growing enough food, huge die-offs of forests, and mass extinctions of plant and animal species. I don't know, do they try to calculate that into a cost matrix here, Gautam?
Well, it's very difficult to calculate exact expectations of what the costs of these will be. For certain things, you can come up with different scenarios, and they have. But there are other things. If you lose species, how do you calculate the cost of that? So they go out of their way to talk about some of the anticipated costs if, you know, sea levels rise, if certain low-lying countries or islands are inundated by higher water levels, what the cost of that would be, increase of, you know, violent storms, the kind of destruction that they can cause. You can put some numbers on that. It is obviously far from an exact science because we don't exactly know how this is going to play out in various parts of the world.
And at a certain point, it's just meaningless to put a number on. How do you, as you say, how do you put the price on a life or millions of lives?
Exactly.
Gautam Nayak with the Wall Street Journal in London. Thank you very much for joining us today, Gautam.
Thank you.
Here's the vice chair of the IPCC in Berlin yesterday saying that there must be a rapid, massive shift to renewable energy. Vice Chair Jim Ski here, talking to the BBC.
It means more clean electricity, it means more on energy efficiency, and we need to start acting now. Because if we don't act now, we will face many dangerous climate change impacts.
Joining me now from Newton, Massachusetts, is Robert Stavins, just back from Berlin, coordinating lead author of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. You can link to that report at our website, onpointradio.org. Robert Stavins is an economist, expert on climate agreements at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, director of the Harvard Environmental Economics Program. Robert Stavins, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
They're talking here about a 40 to 70% reduction in carbon emissions by the year 2050 and 100% by the year 2100. Are there policy options that would make those possible that are doable, Bob? Rob?
Well, you're right to ask about policy because cutting emissions is, first of all, going to require a really wide array of technological measures and also changes in behavior. And none of that is going to happen on its own. And the reason it won't happen on its own is because those measures range from inconvenient to very costly. I know when you look at this in terms of changes in economic growth averaged out into the future, you get this 0.06% number. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the annual differences in GDP, the impacts for many countries in the world, it's quite significant. That said, there are certainly policies that are in place now, and there are certainly potential for more policies. And importantly, those will have to be both at the national level and, because of the global commons nature of the problem, at the international level.
The short time frame for averting the potential risk of the worst is very arresting here, Rob. Paint a picture. They're saying act in 15 years, and then there's more action after that, but in 15 years to head this off, and there's still a chance. Can you just paint a picture of what kind of global action would be required in the next decade and a half to stay on a track that would head us somewhere shy of calamity?
Well, I'll comment in terms of the policy.
Yes.
What's needed is essentially what the European Union, for themselves anyway, are already doing. They were on a 20% goal, and now for 2030 they've committed to a 40% goal.
That is reduction in CO2 emissions.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Now, the United States also, believe it or not, does actually have, you know, climate policies going in place, and we're probably going to achieve, in fact, what is our 2020 target officially, which is a 17% reduction in CO2 emissions below the 2005 levels. Now, that's partly because of natural gas prices. It's partly because of the recent recession. But it's also partly because of a suite of policies that the Obama administration is putting in place through executive orders and regulations.
So to hit this 15-year goal, or the nearest one that you like, you choose, are we talking something like the pace of change that people have already seen in our lives in the last couple of decades? Or would we all feel some kind of pedal to the metal acceleration of change in carbon emissions reductions?
So in order to achieve the kind of targets that are discussed, certainly for 2050, in order to keep temperatures below 2 degrees centigrade increase by the end of the century, very severe policies are going to be required unless, and this is a significant unless there are technological breakthroughs. And that's why an important element of this, in addition to public policy, needs to be accelerated research. And that might come from government funds. It might come from private funds. If there was a price on carbon emissions, we'd see a lot of invention and innovation stimulated.
When you say very severe policies required to keep it under with current technology, like what? You've just got a minute, but give us a couple of examples.
So an example of that, I mean, all policies can be translated into essentially what their cost would be. And so whether or not there are technology standards, there are performance standards that require firms to reduce emissions, their cap and trade systems, or their carbon taxes, we can translate them into what economists call the shadow price of carbon. And that's a good way to think about them. And what I'm suggesting is that what would be needed would be prices on the order of $100 per ton of CO2 emissions. That's far above any standard that any country in the world is currently at.
We're talking this hour about an urgent new call to action on climate change. The new UN report saying we have just 15 years to act to avoid calamity, the potential risk of really bad outcomes for the global environment. Really stern warnings, but also the word that we can do it if we make decisions that put us on the path. Environmentalists welcomed the new report. Here was Kaisa Kosonen, Greenpeace spokesperson, out of talking to Euronews about the Berlin report.
There is certainly hope. This is the strong message of this report, that we have the solutions, we have still time to prevent dangerous climate change, and it's not going to cost us money, it's actually going to save us money, and it's just about speeding up the good trends that are already happening and accepting the fact that we just have to get rid of fossil fuels in the long term.
We have two guests with us today who have been in the middle of the process unfolding this last weekend and earlier in Berlin. Robert Stavins joins us from Newton, Massachusetts, coordinating lead author of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report released in Berlin. You can link to that entire report at our website, onpointradio.org. And from Berlin, Leon Clark joins us now. Leon Clark is lead author on the section of the UN report about the switch from fossil fuels to clean energy. He's senior scientist at the Joint Global Research Institute based at the University of Maryland. Leon Clark in Berlin, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
How do you see the big main headline message out of this report?
Well, to me, there's really three big messages. So the first one is, if we look historically and we look to the future, the problem's really not taking care of itself. And so if we do want to do something about climate change and actually prevent the risk of further harm, we need to act relatively quickly. So that's the first message. The second message that comes out is that there are solutions. And I heard from the last little break you had, the person from Greenpeace talking about how we do have solutions. And that's true. There are solutions. But the third message is, the reason this hasn't really taken care of itself already is that it's actually quite a challenging problem. And it's challenging not just technologically. I think people spend a lot of time thinking about the technology, but actually the institutional and social challenges are really at the core of this problem.
Could you speak to those social challenges? Robert Stavins is saying, we need a heavy price on carbon to get this done, maybe $100 per ton. We'll talk about what the policies might be that would create that. But in terms of lived reality for businesses, for citizens, what would that kind of, heavy one way or another tax or price on carbon mean in terms of business functioning, lifestyle?
Yeah, I think, the report, as was mentioned earlier, makes clear what the total aggregate economic costs would be, and there's different perspectives about how to think about that. But I think what you've just highlighted is actually a key portion of what the issue is. The issue is not just how much it'll influence us in total, but the fact that there are, in fact, folks that will be more influenced than others. Certain businesses will obviously be more influenced than others. Others may be advantaged, but those that are advantaged are often ones that are not around today. For example, if you think about a renewables lobby, is not nearly as strong as lobbies for fuels that are already in use today. So I think that asymmetry is really important. But more generally, I think the institutional challenges have to do with the fact that this is not really at the top of everyone's list. Climate change is not the biggest issue from many perspectives. And also, many of the investment needs to take care of climate change actually take place out of the rich nations, and they have a very different list of priorities than we may have.
So for Americans, paint a bit of a picture for us here. I mean, we're always trying to imagine what it would mean to step up and actually do this. How much would, I don't know, we're talking serious change here, challenging change, as you say. How much would affect lifestyle, standard of living, manner of living? Try and translate it into a picture that people can imagine and buy into or not.
Okay, well, let me give you one example that might be useful. I think one very robust result from research across the scenarios sort of literature that I work with is that a core part of any strategy is a decarbonization of electricity. That means when we say decarbonization, we're no longer producing carbon from electricity, but only using renewables, fossil energy with CCS, nuclear power, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, around 2050. So over the next, say, 35 years, we're really going to replace all of the emitting technologies we have with non-emitting technologies. And, of course, those are more expensive. And if they're more expensive, then that means higher electricity prices. So that's one sort of thing that you would see. But also, depending on how optimistic or pessimistic we are about it, you know, we may be talking about more efficient cars, whether it's through CAFE standards or new technologies. We could be talking electric cars, which would use the new electricity sources, more efficient homes, and so forth. So it's a range of measures.
Rob Stavins, picture that, replacing all carbon-emitting electricity production technologies by 2050. What does that mean in terms of cost to businesses, to citizens? Does it mean we're eating gruel and living in huts? Are we living sort of like now, simply to have different sources of energy? How do you picture it, Rob?
Well, I mean, two things would happen. One is that, as Leon correctly said, the price of electricity will increase substantially, and that's just simply because if you ignore climate change impacts, coal is essentially extremely cheap. It's now competing in the United States with natural gas, but the U.S. is quite unusual in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
And renewable sources of power, whether, you know, wind, solar, et cetera, and for that matter, nuclear power, which is carbon-free, are much, much more expensive. The costs will vary tremendously. You know, to take one of the poster child industries, cement production. Cement production involves both a lot of energy use, so there's that, those emissions, but also the process itself generates CO2. So you'd see massive increases in the price of cement produced by current methods.
Okay.
In a growing economy, take China as an example, or any of the emerging economies in the developing world, where you're putting in a lot of new infrastructure, a lot of construction,
Yep. That's
exceptionally important. I think the main thing for listeners to keep in mind is that when we say that it's increasing the cost of various industries, that means increasing the cost of producing goods and services, and that means increasing costs to all of us for buying those goods and services. So there isn't some kind of free lunch that we're going to push off costs onto industry and manufacturing. We're going to feel it.
Climate policy is not a free lunch. We heard that right at the news conference in Berlin on Sunday. Rob Stavins, Leon Clark, please stand by. Let me begin to bring our listeners in. Daniel in Jasper, Indiana. Daniel, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just had a comment, I guess. I think that I'm actually a very strong green advocate, and I am also a coal miner. I'm probably the only one out there.
Okay. Rare combination, coal miner and green advocate, but there you are, Daniel. What do you think, then, in that situation?
Well, the guys that I work with, and they fight for those jobs. Mm-hmm. The jobs that they have, they fight for them because they can make $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year, and they only need a 2-week education to get it, 2-week safety training.
Right. So no college degree or PhD required, just 2 weeks and in.
No, that's it. That's all you need.
Yeah.
And they make that kind of money, and that's why they fight for those jobs. They get, you know, 100% insurance. They fight very hard for those jobs because
sure.
of that.
Yeah.
And if we could find a way, I'm into coal mining because of out of necessity, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can find a way to get those kinds of jobs with green energy, we would have people fighting for the same types of jobs. I mean, it would just be, you have to get the general public involved in it or it's not going to be an issue.
But it becomes a no-brainer, I suppose, if the jobs are there that are comparable. That is a very interesting perspective. Let me take it up with my guest, Daniel. I appreciate your call from Jasper, Indiana. Leon Clark, speak to it. I mean, there's the political pushback that comes from the coal industry, coal miners. Are they roadkill in the scenario that the panel outlines in Berlin, or is there another path that opens up for them?
That's a great question. So I think that that your caller has articulated basically one of the biggest challenges, which is there could be winners and losers. That's true. And clearly it's true that unabated or freely emitting fossil fuel use needs to go down. But in the case of coal and other fossil uses, particularly in electricity, there are options. So carbon dioxide capture and storage is a technology that could be used to allow us to continue to use coal. And in that technology, you produce the electricity, but you take the CO2 and then you pump it underground. And the U.S. actually has looked into this a great deal. And
clean coal.
What's that?
Clean coal, I guess, is the tag. People know that.
It would
by.
Be clean coal, but beyond just not emitting various particulates and so forth, this is about actually pumping the CO2 underground into saline aquifers and storing it there.
Is that a realistic option that we could have coal miners and green policy sufficient to meet these deadlines?
Well, it's certainly a realistic technology in the sense that we know how to do it. There are questions about this technology and pretty much every technology in terms of what they would mean at scale. And that's one of the things I think people don't entirely appreciate. This trying to address this problem in a growing global economy that might have energy use as much as 3 times or 4 times higher in the future means deploying these technologies at scales we just really haven't thought of before. But also, I want to point out one thing that your caller's question raises, which is the key here is that the solutions really need to be customized to local or regional circumstances. So this coal, many countries have coal. Those are countries that, if they're going to be successful, are going to need to be thinking about carbon dioxide capture and storage as a way to use coal still going forward. We talk a lot about nuclear. There's been a lot of concern about that after Fukushima, and Japan, Germany are not going to be using nuclear power, at least at this point. But if you go to China, they have a very different opinion about it. And I think one of the key things for folks to remember is there is no single solution. The solutions really need to be customized to the local circumstances and the local societal priorities.
Rob Stavins, let me ask you then two things. First, to our caller's question. In a scenario where we take up this challenge and we do it, we fend off this climate change with aggressive action, are there those $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year jobs for no college education coming in for Daniel and his fellow coal miners somehow? And secondly, if Leon Clark in Berlin is correct, we have to customize all this to local circumstance. That sounds like a patchwork of micro policies. One wonders if they'll add up globally to sufficient change?
Well, first, Tom, to the first of the two questions, I think it's good to keep in mind what's happened to coal use in the United States. So as a result of the fall in the price of natural gas, there has been a drastic shift for the generation of electricity from coal to natural gas.
Yeah.
Absolutely unprecedented. Now, that taking place...
And a lot of jobs in North Dakota and elsewhere. People may not like fracking, but there have been jobs with it.
That's correct. And so we're seeing a switch there from one sector to another. However, it's also good to keep in mind that the coal industry has not actually been hurt by that, because there's been substitution, less use of coal in the United States and more export of coal from the United States.
So net for the global climate, I'm not so sure about.
That's absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. So that brings us back really to your second question, and that is different countries, different circumstances. But for any country, the benefits of reducing climate change are going to be spread over the world, right? If we take action in Massachusetts or the United States, we pay the cost of taking action, but the benefit, the reduced risk of climate change, is spread absolutely globally. What that means is that for any individual jurisdiction, the benefits of taking action, the direct benefits, will inevitably be less than the direct costs. even though globally the benefits might be much greater than the costs, which is in fact what we've said in this most recent IPCC report.
Okay.
That means international cooperation is required. Countries on their own are not going to do it.
I mean, the old gridlock here was a standoff between rich and poor countries, the poor saying, you want us to do this? Pay us to do this. And also between newly industrialized and old industrial powers, who's going to bear the burden here? Leon Clark, you're there in Berlin. Do you see any break in that gridlock? It really has gummed things up for a long time.
Well, I can't comment on whether there will be a breakthrough in that gridlock. All I can say is that in this report, we've tried to do our best to give a sense, basically if you go back to the underlying document, about where emissions have come from and where they may be coming from in the future and what that implies for what different regions might do. And we've also tried to cast a lot of this within the context of understanding some of the different ethical frameworks by which one might be thinking about understanding how the burdens would be shared. Now, whether that sort of information is that, oh, and actually should add that much of the work that Rob's been looking at is then means to actually facilitate international cooperation. Whether this set of information will actually spur folks to get past the issues that they face, that's a very different question.
Let's go to Blaine in Lancaster, Massachusetts. Blaine, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have two quick points. I find myself in the camp that disagrees with your guess. I do not think our fossil fuel usage is behind climate change. And secondly, in terms of resources, we have limited resources financially, I'm speaking, not energy-wise. My wife and I find ourselves as the 50% of folks that actually pay taxes in this country, so we can't absorb any more costs. I've got three children to raise and educate, so when I hear guests talk about costs being passed on to us, we just can't do it. You know, I think money spent towards providing more clean water for the world, more food sources, I think that takes priority over dubious claims about man-made climate change.
Hey, Blaine, I get the part about a monthly budget and how hard it can be to meet it, and I know exactly how that feels. But when you say you don't think fossil fuels are driving this, you know, you sound like a smart guy. Where do you come up with that? Because all these scientists say it is. So why do you say it's not?
Well, first off, science isn't run on consensus. Facts are facts. Theories are theories. With all due respect to your guests, these are theories, not facts. If you look at how the climate changed in the world from 1900 to 1950, there was climate change there. But if you look at the rate of fossil fuel use, it was obviously less during that time period than it is now.
Let me pick that up right there. Our time is short before the break. I appreciate your call. Leon Clark, speak to that assertion from our citizen caller that, you know, he just doesn't believe it.
Well, I think it's important for all of us to be able to express a variety of different opinions, and we as scientists welcome a wide variety of opinions about whether how much climate might be changing, whether humans are causing it, and so forth. But at the same time, the scientific consensus is essentially unequivocal, which is that warming of the climate system is happening, and that the human influence is a major portion of this. So. I certainly welcome the notion that that there are various opinions. The science is very much in favor of this happening.
Do you call that a fact now? Our listener doesn't.
Oh, whether it's a fact or not, I would say that the scientific consensus is that it's unequivocal.
That sounds pretty strong. Leon Clark in Berlin, please stand by there. Rob Stavins in Newton, Massachusetts. We're talking about an urgent new call to action on climate change. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about an urgent new call to action on climate change. The new UN report saying we have just 15 years to act to avoid calamity, the risk of major, major environmental changes clicking into gear that would be very hard to reverse. Leon, Rob, it's interesting the range of response online here. People saying, yes, let's go, ready to do it. But a whole range of ideas. Leanne says, I wish I was 80 years old instead of 40. I guess, Leon, she's thinking, you know, she doesn't want to be around for this if we don't get on the stick here. And here's another listener who says, Western societies, Western capitalism are way too self-centered to take action or spend money on a problem that our senior leaders will never see the benefits of. We're not evolved yet to that level of empathy. Rob Stavins, you look at policy. You've seen and listened to this conversation for decades now. The report says the policy conversation is evolving, that the panel sees more readiness to address this challenge than in the past. Do you see that, Rob?
Well, I do. I mean, there's vastly more public attention to the problem, and the United States is an outlier. I know that there's this large degree of climate skepticism of whether or not the problem is real in the U.S. among a subset of the population. That's actually not true in other parts of the world, whether it's Europe or any part or Asia, any parts of the world. It's really concentrated here. So globally, there's much more of a will for action. We're seeing more climate policies in most countries, including in the United States, although they're not enough to put us on the right trajectory to address the magnitude of the threat. I think it's helpful to keep in mind that emissions in the OECD countries, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, more or less the industrialized world, those emissions are flat to declining. The major growth, this rapid growth we're seeing in emissions that's accelerating, is coming from the emerging economies. And I'm not saying this to point fingers, but to understand the nature of the problem. That's China, India, Brazil, Korea, South Africa, Mexico, and Indonesia, these large, rapidly growing economies. So as you know, I heard Rajendra Pachauri on the recording you had at the beginning of the program say, he talked about a train leaving a station. And my view is that unless they get on the global climate policy train, it's not leaving the station. But that doesn't mean they have to pay for their tickets. These are two different problems. They have
Who's going to pay if they don't? Who will pay?
Well, that's through various policy mechanisms. That's how the industrialized world can be helpful. Because, in fact, it would be much cheaper for us in the richer part of the world to finance emissions reductions in the poor parts of the world than to carry out those same magnitude of emissions reductions here. And that's because we have already have much more efficient economies.
Are you calling China and India poor countries in that equation?
Well, when I use the word poor in that case, but they're really moving into middle-income countries at this point.
But are you saying the U.S. and Europe should pay for China and India's cleanup?
The only way this is going to happen is if those countries are the location of most of the action and if there is some financing mechanism from the Western world. That's correct.
Leon, is there a hostage-taking here in effect dynamic? That are those countries saying you pay for our cleanup or we're all going down?
I think Rob is going to be more on top of that than I am. But I would say that, in fact, that is exactly what's going on. And I think one thing that's interesting to point out is that if current trends continue, this notion of historical responsibility, this is something Rob has pointed out in the past, is going to be changing. So a lot of the discussions now have to do with who actually is responsible for where we are. And we can look to the richest countries because historically they've produced most of the emissions. But with the rapid growth in places like China, that's going to change. And there's going to be countries 10 years, 20 years from now who were not responsible for historical emissions in the same way that we are today, who are going to be equal to us. And so I think a lot of that dynamic is actually changing and will be changing because those countries really are moving out of those income groups. So there is a distinction between some of these countries that are moving towards more advanced economies and those that are really quite poor.
Rob, we see the photographs out of China, and we hear India maybe even worse in some ways. It just looked terrible. We hear that China, at least, is beginning to move on more effective policies. Might they not see it as simply in their own interest to be hyper-aggressive on cleaning up because it looks chokingly uncomfortable already there?
Well, that's exactly what's happening, Tom. So there's a tremendous amount of action happening in China that affects CO2 emissions, that lowers it below what they otherwise would be. But it's not because of climate change or CO2. It's because there's a high degree of correlation between those CO2 emissions and localized air pollutants, particulates and ozone or smog. And that's where there's very serious concern in China, partly for reasons of political stability.
Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Bob, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you. Very important discussion today. Gentlemen, please allow me to just put my point of view in here about the nuclear industry creates a whole new kind of a cleanup that can't be limited to local and regional solutions. It becomes international problem. Nuclear industry, number one, not good idea. Can't go there. India and other countries that are, China in particular, need to reforest, need to make economy out of reforesting. And there is cultural change coming in agriculture if we can just keep Monsanto's hands off of it.
Bob, let us pick up the nuclear piece. Rob Stavins, what about it? Can we meet these aggressive goals without nuclear power?
I think, given the magnitude of the challenge, it's important not to rule anything out. So I would include in that, you know, renewables, carbon capture and storage to be able to continue increasing using coal, natural gas as a transition fuel, and nuclear power. It should be an all-of-the-above approach. It's not going to work by taking things off the table before you even start talking.
James in Columbia, South Carolina. James, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
There's two big problems in the climate change discussion. One is, on the opposing side, they always say there's always a hot and a cold shift in on the Earth. And that's true. But the problem is right now is the speed at which we're going will not allow for environmental adaptation.
Yes.
And maybe even human adaptation.
Yeah.
And the second thing is on the side for, climate change is we have a lot of hypocrites. They're not willing to take the steps that are required to affect climate change. In other words, they don't invest. Some of them have a lot of money, and they don't invest it into the studies or to the equipment. Look at the cars they drive. Look at the houses they live in and the way they live.
You mean, James, even if they see it coming, they're hypocritical in responding. They don't respond.
Correct. Mm-hmm. I mean, I live in a house. My electric bill is one-third the cost of some of the people, most of the people live around me because I pay attention to what I'm doing. I do farming, and I try to do it environmentally safe. Some people around here call me the truck driver, woodwork, and environmentalist because I know that with care you can do things. I try to get good gas mileage. I drive correctly. I do woodwork. I try to get sustainable forest-supplied wood. But I care about the environment. I'm not a tree hugger, but I do care.
Yeah.
And the problem is there's people that they care, but they're just not willing to commit. And if they have the money or the time, they just don't commit. And it's hypocritical, and that sways the other side to say, look, you're not doing it.
Yeah, James, we've got it. I mean, it's hard to deny that point. Sometimes it's hard for people to get their heads around it and then maybe to take the steps to action required by the theme of a report like this one, even when they do. And here's Alan writes to us. He says, what I wonder is what climate event will have to occur to create a tidal wave of political and individual effort to change. He's writing online to us here. Will it be a massive hurricane that wipes out Miami? Or will we be like frogs in the cook pot and simply get used to worse and worse small events until it's too late? What's your sense, Rob Stavins, of where we are in that catalytic gradual understanding, or will it take some terrible whack, you know, across the side of the head to get our attention?
I think that's a great question. And what I think about is the fact that the history of environmental regulation in the United States has come about as a result of observed or presumed disasters. So let's think about the Cuyahoga River catching on fire in Cleveland, Ohio, yeah, 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
The next morning in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, there were no articles that said, well, rivers periodically catch on fire, yeah, for natural reasons.
Yeah.
It was obvious, and that led to the Clean Water Act within 18 months. However, in the case of climate change, as the caller was implicitly pointing out, none of us observe the climate. None of us. We observe the weather.
Yeah.
And the weather varies tremendously within any given climate. There's a signal-to-noise ratio problem in terms of human beings, including myself, observing what is happening. So that's a tremendous challenge. And therefore, relying on the political process, which has so successfully in the United States brought us environmental statutes since the first Earth Day, is probably not going to work going forward. What's needed really is enlightened political leadership at the very highest levels. That's what's going to be required. And obviously breaking of the deadlock of political polarization that's come to exist, particularly in the House of Representatives.
I mean, it's hard to see that emerging just at the high levels without some large public movement to give those leaders a sense that the population will be behind them. Barack Obama talked a pretty strong game, but he didn't make it the emphasis of his first term in office once he was elected, Rob.
Well, that was for a variety of reasons.
Well, there's always reasons, right? I mean, it's inconvenient.
It is costly, but there are specific reasons. Remember, that legislation was tried in the midst of the greatest recession the United States has faced since the Great Depression, mm-hmm. and things had already been polarized partly by going first with health care. What I'm saying is that the prognosis going forward is that this bottom-up demand, which normally we certainly always want to have and rely on in a representative democracy, is, in my view, unlikely to work in the case of climate change policy as it has for other environmental problems. It's going to have to be the leaders taking the lead.
Boy, that's I'm not sure how that works, given the cost, and you can get kicked out of office if you don't have the population behind you. Leon, here's a listener who writes online, I've never disagreed with the apparent consensus that the Earth is warming and humans are to blame. But James writes, he says, I've just come to question whether the cost of addressing this is worth it. What about the cost of addressing it versus the cost of not addressing it, Leon?
Well, that's a good question. So the report that we just came out with articulates what the costs are, what the cost might be to address it. And even there, there's a wide range of uncertainty about what the cost would be. If you think out 100 years, it's very hard to know exactly how much it would cost to do this. There's a wide range of uncertainties. But that's the cost of reducing emissions. What we don't have right now from Working Group 2, which is one of the other two working groups of the IPCC, is a clear assessment of what would be the reduced damages from climate change. There are some assessments in that report, highly uncertain, of what the damages might be if we actually did reduce emissions. But there's not a really good sense, in any meaningful way, of what the damages would be if we didn't do anything. And so that turns out to be a real serious problem. You look at the cost. People say, oh, look, we've seen costs. As one of your earlier callers said, you know, I can't take any more hits on my pocketbook and so forth, and that's quite fair. But there would be hits potentially on people's pocketbooks if we don't do anything. But given that that's so uncertain and it's in the future, it's really hard to put that into a calculus where people feel comfortable. If they know it's going to cost something, they know exactly what the two choices are, then it's very easy to make that choice.
Is that still so vague in IPCC circles? I mean, a week or two ago, we had the first, an earlier one of these reports, and now this one. I mean, we've been reading headlines saying that the impact is already hitting. They're talking about ice sheets collapsing, sea level rise, you know, food shortage, extinctions. Those hardly sound cost-free at all, Leon. They sound almost apocalyptic.
Yeah, that's a really good point. There's two ways that we think about the damages from climate change and how we might reduce them. One is the sort of classic economic way. Can we put an economic value on those? And that's something that we have a hard time doing. Yet at the same time, when we talk about...
What kind of morons are we if we can't put an economic value on ice sheet collapse? I mean, how smart do you have to be to understand that that would be very costly?
I think we can understand that it would be very costly. I think that's true. I think what's hard is figuring out exactly how costly. And there's a wide range of other issues that come up. There's ecosystem loss. There's biodiversity losses. There's human health, which raises a whole host of issues associated with how you value people's lives and so forth. There's a range of issues that make it very hard to quantify. And in addition to that, we don't have a great feel for exactly what it will be like if we have temperature change of 6 or 7 degrees centigrade. So I agree that we have a sense that it's a large magnitude, but until there's a real clear sense of what those numbers are, what you find is that on the reducing emission side, we come with economic costs, but then on the benefit side, what would we gain from reducing climate change? What would we gain from not having a changed climate? We don't have those numbers, and it makes it very hard to do a cost calculus.
We better pull our heads out of our spreadsheet a little bit there. Carol in London, Kentucky. Carol, you're on the air.
Thank you. Hi. I just wanted to say it's time to stop being polite about this. Stop the subsidies to the oil and gas companies today and put it to the development of clean, green solar and what other alternatives there are, certainly not nuclear. And we have to do it now.
Stop being polite. Let's go. $4 billion a year in tax incentives for fossil fuel production in this country. Rob Stavins, could we shift that over, put it into green energy production, and turbocharge our way forward here?
Well, one of the things that the IPCC report just released in Berlin talks about and demonstrates is the importance of reducing greenhouse gas subsidies, principally subsidies, obviously, for fossil fuels globally. There was an agreement by the G20 countries in Pittsburgh a few years ago. Heads of state were present, including President Obama, and they agreed to begin to do this globally. The resistance, of course, it hasn't been implemented. The resistance really comes from some major developing countries for whom keeping energy prices low to their populations they perceive to be very important. So this was actually quite controversial in Berlin in our discussions this past week.
This challenge not going away, but this report putting it front and center, just how much speed and determination it will take if we want to head off these major changes. Rob Stavins was there in Berlin, joined us today from Newton, Massachusetts. Rob, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
And Leon Clark, lead author on the section on switching from fossil fuels to clean energy. Leon, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure as well.
Listeners, thanks for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Good to be back with you. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.